dust is thick and it's galling. It simply can't be excused. In winter, even the falling snow looks used. My window pane may not give much light, but I see you, so the view is bright. If I can love you, I'll pay the dirt no heed. With your love, what more do I need?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway for Sunday, November 13th, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his photography at followspotphoto.com. You can see his writing at broadwaystars.com, and he also writes for the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You can read books of his. He writes full-length books.
Imagine
that. And the most recent of
Remember Books.
Yeah, remember books. Well, you can get them on the Kindle now, too. The Broadway Musical MVPs, 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. It's now available through Applause Books and at Amazon.com and various other places like the Drama Bookshop. Peter, is it available at the Drama Bookshop? It should be.
Yep.
You had a reading.
Yeah.
Great. Good morning.
Hi.
Also, Peter writes for the Newark Star-Ledger. He also writes for Kritzerland on Fridays and Masterwork Broadway on Tuesdays. So we have a very full schedule here of things to talk about. Let's start off with Godspell. The revival musical by Stephen Schwartz is now at the Circle in the Square. And Peter, tell me what you thought about it.
Well, it's a show that didn't get very good reviews, and I don't think it's going to matter much. I think that just as Stephen Schwartz's show Upstairs 8 years ago didn't get good reviews and is still with us, I'm not saying that Godspell will last 8 years, because revivals tend not to run as long as the original productions, but boy, did the audience have a wonderful time when I went to see it last Wednesday. And if that audience is representative of any other, and I think it will be. It's going to be around a while. It got past that terrible opening of the Tower of Babel has always, to me, got the show off on a terribly wrong foot, and I wish it weren't in there. Mm-hmm. I find it very interesting that the original cast album didn't begin with it. And I honestly believe if I had been listening to the original cast album and way back when, 40 years ago, when I got it and heard that Tower of Babel, I would have taken it off right then and there. So I think it was very smart not to put it on. Mm-hmm. But after that happens, you get into, I think, what is really one of the best scores ever written for the musical theater. I adore the Godspell score. There's not one thing in it that I don't like after that moment. And also, this is one of the rare situations where when a movie was made, a song was dropped, a new one was put in. The song that was dropped, We Beseech Thee, which I'm crazy about, was replaced by a song called Beautiful City. And what's so nice is that now so many productions use both songs. And this production is no exception, that they use both songs. So you get that little extra bonus of hearing yet another wonderful Stephen Schwartz song. I don't know. On a certain level, to me, Godspell has never made sense. I mean, here comes Jesus, and he's arrived. And there are all these people who don't resemble the apostles that I know of. So I don't. Is this a second coming? I really don't know. On a certain level, it doesn't make sense to me. But I certainly enjoy it for what it is. There are more anachronisms in it than probably any other show could possibly have, because here's Jesus saying the parables that we hear, that we read in the Bible, and yet people are coming out with also references to Lindsay Lohan and what have you. And it's also interesting to me that so many of the anachronisms that they used in 1971 are no longer there, like references to Jennifer Cavallari. And if you don't know who she is, then you weren't around during that period of time. Because believe me, there was a time when everybody in America knew the name Jennifer Cavallari. So it's strange. There's a little preciousness about the way the show has always been in terms of the actors. You know, that they're just so wide-eyed and accepting about everything Jesus tells them. But oh, that score, you know. And I have to say, though, that the audience was crazy for every anachronism they heard. They enjoyed that part of it immeasurably. And, you know, it wasn't just that they were laughing. You heard that occasional, ah, you know, that clap of hands that people give, that single clap when they're really just so overwhelmed that that almost takes over involuntarily. So, and, you know, the other thing, too, is that given that it's encircling the square, I think a lot of people who go to rock concerts are going to really like the fact that they're seeing an arena show, so to speak. And they've never been closer to any show that's been in an arena, chances are. So I think that they're going to feel right at home at Circle and Square, those people who don't go to the theater very often. So all in all, I think we have an audience pleaser here. And I think Steve Schwartz may very well find that the bad reviews that dogged his Upstairs production for only a couple of weeks will find history repeating itself here. And I think this is going to be around.
Michael, what did you think about it?
Yeah, I'm not even going to speculate as to how well it's going to do because I really don't know. I've been talking about that with a lot of people, and you know, it's there's so many variables in terms of word of mouth and the type of show that it is, and some people are saying people aren't going to go see it because they can go see it at you know, at any local high school or community theater. But as I've said before, I think that, and especially nowadays, familiarity seems to be the thing, in one of the things, major things in selling a show on Broadway, because people are, you know, ticket prices are so high in general that people don't want to take any chance that they're not going to like something. So if they know they at least like the show itself and the score, you know, then that's obviously a huge chunk of it. But anyway, I certainly Peter's not going to get any argument from me about the score. I've always loved it. I think it's absolutely great. It's simple in the best way, but also more complex than one might realize. Especially, I've been talking to a couple of musical directors recently, and I never did the whole show, but I did a review once where we did a couple of songs from it, and I was interested to find that like the harmonies, some of the harmonies are much more complex than one might think when just listening to it. So I've always loved the show. This production I think is tremendously hit and miss. In the sense that I don't mind the modern day references at all. Those have always been in Godspell from day
sure.
one.
Sure.
So I don't. Some people apparently it drives them crazy. I'm not sure why, but I don't mind it them per se. But the thing is, I would say in this case, maybe about, you know, about 70%. Of the jokes land really well. And that's a considerable percentage, but that still leaves about 30% that really, some of them like just go land with an absolute thud. And when you're going to have a show like this that depends so much on pop culture references and things like that, every time you have one that just thuds like that, it takes you out of it, and it really has a very kind of adverse effect. I think in a show like Godspell, it needs to be more like, you know, 98% that land. But here there are some that really don't, and I'm amazed that they didn't just take them out because they're so dumb that I don't know why somebody didn't turn to somebody else in previews and say, all right, well, you know, we don't need that because we have 3,000 other jokes. There's one. There's a bit that's been in from the beginning where Jesus says, "He says something like, did I ever tell you that I read feet?" And they then what normally happens is he reads someone's foot. But in this case, he says, "I read feet." They make a really stupid joke about it that nobody laughs at it. I can't recall what the quote unquote punchline is. And then he. And then he doesn't read the person's foot. So I'm like, well, why is that still there? The song All for the Best from day one, there has always been a sort of patter vaudeville section in the middle about how can you remove a speck of dust from your neighbor's eye if all the time you have a great plank in your own? You know, just something that probably had a tremendous significance, you know, 2,000 years ago, but now it just kind of sounds weird. And the quote unquote punchline to that has always been a dud. So in this case, they changed the punchline, but it's still a dud, and it brings that down. So that is one of my two major objections to this show. I'm surprised they didn't have more editing during the preview process. And by the way, this production was directed by Daniel Goldstein, who directed a production several years ago at the Paper Mill Playhouse, upon which this one was supposedly based. But to me, there's almost no relationship. I think actually one of the cast members is a repeat, but the staging itself couldn't be more different. The other one struck me as much more, much less hyperkinetic, much more straightforward, and I don't recall a lot of dud jokes in it. So anyone who thinks who saw the Paper Mill and thinks they're going to see anything remotely similar, I just want you to know you're not.
I agree with that, Michael. It was profoundly different from the Paper Mill version, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. From the vantage point that at least he's obviously given it some thought and has made changes. Whether or not the changes for the better is another story. But right. He didn't sit still on what he had, and I guess there's some merit in that.
Also, you know, I didn't look it up. I should have. Peter, do you remember if the Paper Mill one was choreographed by Christopher Gattelli?
I don't.
I should look that up, because that I would say is one of the great strengths of this production. Some people have felt, you know, that there's too much. I personally don't. Really terrific, fun choreography throughout. And I was always conscious of them being very conscious of playing to all sides of the audience, because as Peter mentioned, in this case, Circle in the Square has been reconfigured for a complete in the round presentation. Many times in the past, it's been a three-quarter thrust, but here it's totally in the round with audience on all sides. And they're very, you know, they go from one side to the other. They're always turning around. You don't have to worry about sitting in the wrong seat, because there is no such thing. So I wanted to mention that. The other major flaw I found was in the performance of Hunter Parrish, whom I saw in Spring Awakening, and he was absolutely fantastic in that as Melchior when he briefly replaced Jonathan Groff. But here, during much of it, he's playing the role of Jesus in a terribly, terribly earnest way, kind of an over-exaggerated, almost as if he was talking to a mentally challenged child, almost to the point of, you know, you would think he was making fun of it. And whenever he does that, I found it tremendously off-putting, and he does a lot of it. When he lets up on that and just says lines naturally, he's really quite terrific. And his voice is very, very beautiful when he's singing anything that's ballady, which most of Godspell is. But he did have some issues in Alas for You, which requires a stronger, more rockish, belty kind of voice. He also, the night I saw it, right after he came on, he sounded kind of froggy, and he actually coughed on stage at one point to clear his throat. The person that I went with and I agreed, we both were wondering if he's going to have problems sustaining 8 a week, because it sounds like it's a very lovely, beautiful voice that doesn't maybe have a lot of stamina to it, and is not suited to anything that tends towards the more rockish, belty kind of singing. So I guess we have to, in a case like this, I guess we really have to wonder why Goldstein didn't sit on him for that delivery that he does, which is I don't know. I've heard other people comment against it also. I don't know why he made that choice, or he was sort of pushed into it, because I think it's really too bad, and I wish they had revisited that.
Daniel Goldstein did direct Paper Mill.
Oh yeah, no, I know he directed. The question was whether Chris Vitelli.
Oh okay, he did. No, he did. No. Baker's Wife at Paper Mill. Mm-hmm. He doesn't list it as. He did Newsies, and he did.
Yeah.
Funny Girl. Mm-hmm. So he listed a bunch of other Paper Mill credits, but he didn't list. Godspell.
So Paper Mill. Not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. All righty. So that wraps up Godspell for us. Next on our agenda is King Lear, which is playing down at the Public. Michael, why don't you start us off with Lear?
Yeah, this is one of those cases where, did you ever see a production that was really, really flawed, but you really loved it anyway? I guess it's the play. You know, it's a really great play. It is one of the greatest plays ever written, I think. And that despite the fact that one of the subplots and one of the subsidiary characters has never, ever worked for me, namely Edmund, Gloucester's son, mm-hmm. who is pure evil, and you don't really know why, and he's like kind of over the top, and he... you know, it just gets a little like ridiculous after a while as to why he's doing what he's doing, and being so obvious about it. But other than that, every other character, including Gloucester and the other brother Edmund, and Lear and his daughters, there were a great many flaws in this production. The set is. there's one coup de théâtre in it, which is really wonderful. But other than that, it really was a little. It could have used more, especially because the other tremendous flaw was the lighting design by Christopher Ackerland, which was so bright through almost the whole thing, and just didn't have a lot of different levels. Even at the end. You know, I mean, again, it had to be a choice, right? But this horrible, tragic, gut-wrenching scene is playing out at the end, and it was the lighting was like midday, and I was like, well, why did they do that for? The scenic design, by the way, is by Miriam Boother, I guess, Boether. And also, the other great flaw is the costume design by Gabriel Berry. No rhyme or reason whatsoever. In the beginning, some of the characters are wearing costumes that are vaguely reminiscent of something that might have been worn, you know, 400 or 500 years ago. But then all of them immediately start to... sport much more contemporary garb, and I didn't know what that point was supposed to be. I wish someone could explain it to me. But having said all that, I thought Sam Waterston was really very effective as King Lear. A very different interpretation, but I've seen so many recently. Kevin Klein. I did not see Derek Jacobi, who apparently was great. Did you see it, Peter?
No.
Yeah. Ian McKellen, Christopher Plummer at Lincoln Center. Sam Waterston, he's so tall, and he looks so tall on stage. He emphasized the petulance and the sort of mental
deterioration and befuddlement of Lear, and that worked very well for me. One of the fascinating things was that Goneril and Reagan were both played very differently than I've ever seen them before. Enid Graham, terrific as Goneril, she was a much colder Goneril, but she. For example, in the scene where Lear curses her and you know kind of curses her unborn child, she reacted by basically collapsing in grief, you know, and crying out. Where I've never seen it done that way before, and it added a whole new level to it, because even this cold, mean, you know, icy woman, we see that there is something under there. The usual reaction is just for her to become furious, but that's not what she did. And our friend Kelly O'Hara as Reagan was a much more pragmatic, seemed like basically a nice woman who was just like getting increasingly annoyed by her father, the two of them together, it just the relationship was very different and very, very intriguing to me. I personally found Bill Irwin terrific in a very difficult role as the fool. This seemed to be to me either completely uncut or almost completely uncut. And while much of the fool's dialogue is wonderful, there's also a lot of filler things that probably like went over like gangbusters in you know in the 16th century, but now they really don't. I give him a lot of props, and Arian Moyed, whom many of us enjoyed greatly in the Bengal Tiger in the Baghdad Zoo, was wonderful in another very difficult role, Edgar, who has to play insane for much of the evening. Michael McKean as Gloucester, it's interesting. I thought he started out very low energy, but then he really got into it as the play went on, and his tragedy was beautifully played by the end. So I we had, you know, wonderful Herb Foster making an appearance as the old man, and John Douglas Thompson, I have to mention, a very, very wonderful, dignified Earl of Kent. So I recommend it. But it's one of those things where I can't disagree with, you know, with most of the criticisms. There was so much wrong with it, but I guess the storytelling ultimately was effective, even if the sets and lighting and costumes and some of the direction and some of the other aspects of it were not. By the way, it's directed by James McDonald, I should mention. So yeah, I mixed feelings on King Lear, but ultimately very, very effective.
Peter, what do you think?
Well, yes, this is a very controversial production, no question. The reviews were not as strong as I'm sure the public theater had hoped they'd be, but I'm with Michael. I thought it was very, very fine in many, many ways.
Oh, really? I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, because there were so many different interpretations that Sam Waterston gave from any Lear that I've seen. Doesn't mean that this is a radical new interpretation. I can't say that. I've seen about 10 King Lears in my time, but this was the first time I saw it played the way Sam Waterston did. And let me explain. Right from the very beginning, everybody is bowing and scraping because the king is about to enter. He does enter, but from a different place from what they're expecting. The wrong door, so to speak.
I love that.
Forward, and he comes from back because that tells you right away, this guy is a little befuddled. And that's what's so special about this King Lear to me, that here is a man who is losing it already. And that would explain a great deal. It would explain why he trusts his daughter so much. It explains why he overreacts to what Cordelia has to say, that it doesn't please him. So I thought that was really substantiated. So he's already going mad. Also, the way he walked was like a Lippincott stallion. It was a very strange walk. He is cracking up. You know, that is definitely happening. At one point, he takes the fool's hat off and he puts it on himself. And you know what this reminds me of? When politicians do this, when they're at some sort of roast and they do something silly, and photographers take that picture. And whenever the politician does something wrong or stupid, they run that picture to indicate that. So so I thought that was interesting. Also, this is an era where we hear a lot about elder abuse. There are many, many stories around about how children abuse their parents. So in a strange way, this is a very topical King Lear. What I also liked was the fact that every now and then he became very lucid because, indeed, older people, you've heard this expression, he has good days and he has bad days. So I thought that was very substantial. He wheezed between lines, which I thought was really good, too. The wheezing, you know, indicating some. It also stressed the fact that old age makes decisions for us. If it wants us to be senile, then senile will be. I mean, that's it. Lear fears it. But he knows that that his regal rule should overcompensate. He really believes that because he's used to being king. So all this came out, and I thought that was terrific. A very cautionary tale to baby boomers, by the way, because we're not getting any younger, and maybe we should watch out how much power we give our children and how much we expect from them. So. But he was wonderful when he even gave the the line, "Do not make me mad." He said that to Gloucester, and he got in the word "mad." The way he said it conveyed both the two meanings of mad:
yeah,
angry and insane. So I liked that he got that out of that. I agree that the set isn't much, but I long ago came to terms with the fact that we're not going to see elaborate sets in Shakespeare. And Michael does mention a coup de théâtre, and indeed, that's a very effective moment. Though my heart bleeds for the people who have to deal with it after the techies who have to deal with it afterwards. I'm saying no more purposely. Yes. I agree with Michael about Michael McKean. Once his tragedy happens, wow, he really goes into gear, and it really becomes, in his worst hour, his finest hour in the way that he handles it. It's really terrific. So I like that. Also, this is today this comes across, too, as a play that shows us how inadvertently comments on how fragile our leaders are and how easily they can be ruined. I thought that was effective as well. So maybe the lights are up because it's 3 hours and 25 minutes. They were petrified that people would fall asleep, but I sure didn't. I was taken with this King Lear. It's one of the best ones I've ever seen. And I understand a lot of people aren't going to feel this way or haven't felt this way. But it had me from the beginning to show Lear more doddering than I had ever seen him, which really explained to me, indeed, why he would divide his kingdom and why he would expect certain things said by his children and nothing else but those certain things would do. So I recommend it.
Well, it seems to be getting a lot of very popular reaction, if not if the critical reaction wasn't as good as it might have been. I wonder how ticket sales are going. Have you heard anything?
No. No, one rarely hears about how ticket sales are going places
public.
Like the Public. You know, yeah. I mean, we know every week from Variety and the websites how the Broadway shows are doing. It's always amazed me why, I mean, I've been reading Variety since 1963, and it always amazed me from day one why the grosses for off-Broadway shows were never published. All right, a non-profit thing, fine, I sort of understand. But on the other hand, we have Broadway shows that are not-for-profit that are listed in those grosses every week. So it's never been satisfactorily explained to me why even commercial off-Broadway shows don't report their grosses.
I think I can explain it.
Oh, good.
Well, Broadway grosses come from the league.
Right.
Yeah.
And there isn't as organized an organization as the League for Off-Broadway.
You would think by now there would be.
Well, there's been many attempts to do so, and there is, an informal off-Broadway league and things like that, but it is very loosely held together. It's not as you know, mandatory as, you know, you have absolutely no option. When you produce a Broadway show, you have to join the league. You don't have an option. You have to join it or else you can't produce. And it's not the same way off-Broadway. And off-Broadway organizations come and go and are not as stable as Broadway organizations. So I'd imagine that that would be why off-Broadway doesn't get reported. And then you also have what is, you know, considered off-Broadway, off-Broadway.
Yeah, all set there. But still, James, what was that Young Frankenstein thing a few years ago when they didn't want to report their grosses?
Well, they still had to join the league, but they chose not to report. It was Mel Brooks. And
I see. So the league does not demand that you release
strongly
your
encourages. I see. And if you're not Mel Brooks...
And at the height of his power at that point.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be hard. You know, I think that the league... Well, I won't say that.
Okay.
I think that there were lawyers involved. It's another way in which Broadway shows get their name is consistently in the news every week. You know, even if you're at the bottom of the list, you're still on the list, and no such thing as bad PR. They say.
Although I, again, it's like shouting into the wind, but I continue to be annoyed by constant press releases saying that such and such a show has again broken the house record at such and such a theater.
Book of Mormon?
Because we all know that that's because of ticket prices. And that just, my pet peeves.
Getting out of the Broadway realm, you know, you look at, movie grosses, and movie grosses are like, oh, we did $100 million whatever. But you're not Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. If Gone with the Wind had today's prices, it would still be the most popular movie by far, outpacing Titanic 10-1.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's same thing with Broadway. If we had Broadway prices back in the day of Oklahoma. Would it have run this long, or
but maybe even longer? Who knows?
Yeah,
the way things are now.
Grosses and everything are merely just hype.
They sure are. Speaking of prices, it brings up that marvelous story about the first preview of Jacques Brel when they had sold $8 worth of tickets, because tickets could be $4 in those days. So they had sold a pair. Somebody had asked the producer, how are you doing? You know, do you have an advance sale? He says, terrible. You won't believe it. You will not believe how bad we're doing. $16. That's what we've sold. And even there, he had to double the gross, as pathetic as it was, you know. So,
and the next week, they said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "Well, you know, we've doubled our grosses."
Absolutely, we're a hit. And they were, in fact, but that's another story.
You know, truly, the only way to measure how popular a show is to look on the scalper websites. See, you know, what's available and what the pricing is, and that's the real true indication of the market that's independent. All right, so that wraps up King Lear.
Me just say, if please do go see it if
you can get tickets.
It's, you know, so much of it is you sit there and you think, God, how this man was such a genius. How could he have written this so long ago?
Without a computer.
You know, you think people really haven't changed. The scene where where the two daughters are bargaining with him as to how many nights they're going to let him keep, and you know, and they sort of play they play against each other, and you know, and then the scene where he suddenly, as you said, Peter, he has his good days and his bad days, and he has moments of lucidity. And the scene where he suddenly, in the middle of, you know, of nothing, he just turns and he says, "I did her wrong," realizing what a tremendous mistake he made in banishing Cordelia from his life. It just gets you, you know, it just really gets you.
Well, what's fascinating too to me is the fact that Lear doesn't trust a child, and that means ruination. While Gloucester distrusts a child that he shouldn't distrust, and that leads to ruination as well. It's very hard to make the right decision with children, as I think is one of the messages of the play. Very hard.
Well, I'm going to go see it, and I have two things to think about all throughout the show is, did Shakespeare actually write it?
Absolutely.
as anonymous as we can't escape all the stories and promos and everything else from the big Hollywood movie of did Shakespeare write his shows? And then I have to really find the subtext in Kelly O'Hara's performance.
Well, as the line goes in New Faces of 1968, Shakespeare did not write his plays, but they were written by somebody just as good.
All right, next up on the agenda is Venus and Fur. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with this production at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater?
Well, this was first done at Classic Stage a couple of years ago, and suddenly we had a brand new star, Nina Arianda, and it really goes to show that if you've got the talent and you get the right role, it doesn't take long to become a sensation in the town. She is the new girl in town, and she's tremendous in it. What's really nice too is that she's getting a second chance to show those people who didn't see it downtown, because after all, there are people who simply do not go to Off-Broadway. So it's very nice that she is getting this second chance. And we have a new leading man, Hugh Dancy, and he's doing very well by her. I'm going to do a minority report about the play, though. I'm not complaining about the play, which does involve an audition. An actress comes in. She wants to audition for this play, Venus and Fur, which is based on a notorious book from way back when by Sasser Mashok. And the thing is that the director, of course, doesn't want to see her, but eventually gets convinced into doing it. And it leads to a bit of an S&M session that's much too severe, because nothing... no whips come out of chains or anything like that. But nevertheless, it becomes a dominant submissions situation. And what I noticed about being there with the Manhattan Theater Club audience, which is an older and more conservative audience, it seems to me, than many Broadway audiences, was a feeling of discomfort. I may be overreacting here. I may be reading into this, but it seemed to me they did not really enjoy the show as much as they wanted to. And I think because it is kinky. Many of us have seen many kinkier things. Don't misunderstand me. And I didn't find it problematic on that level. But I did feel that the house wasn't going along with it. As a result of that, I was reminded of something I thought a long time ago when O Calcutta opened, and that is the fact that I think people enjoy such things in the privacy of their own home, and they get uncomfortable when people around them are witnessing their potential reaction to what's going on stage, that they're afraid to laugh at something, afraid to gasp at something, or just afraid to react at something. Now, of course, I mention O Calcutta specifically because O Calcutta certainly ran a long time, both in its first Broadway run and its revival run, where it certainly flourished. But it's often been said that Japanese tourists were responsible for keeping O Calcutta alive for all that time. And again, all of us know that when we go out of town, and nobody knows who we are, we have a tendency to be different people. And so as a result, Japanese tourists may have gone to that show figuring, nobody knows who I am, and so I can be myself here. But again, I'm not sure I'm right about this theory. And again, maybe it isn't just Japanese tourists that kept O Calcutta going for all those years. But nevertheless, I did feel an uncomfortable feeling in that house. And as a result, I don't know if this was the ideal show to do at the Friedman Theater on Broadway. Certainly, Manhattan Theater Club has had a nice relationship with David Ives, and it's his play. And certainly, Walter Bobby will always be get work because people hope that he'll come up with a show that will run as long as Chicago. But nevertheless, I wasn't sure this was the right fit for this audience, and I wonder if there will be any ramifications as a result of it.
Well, you know, that's so interesting you mentioned that, because at the performance I went to during the show is an hour and 45 minutes without intermission, apparently a little longer than it was downtown, where everyone made a point that it was only 90 minutes. So it would seem that it's been padded a little bit. But during the course of this 1 hour and 45 minute performance with no intermission, six people left the theater during the performance and then returned to their seats, including a very tall fellow seated right in the front row. I've never seen anything like it. And I complained to the house manager, who looked at me like I had two heads. He's like, I can't prevent people from going to the bathroom. And I said, well, you could prevent them from returning to their seat, especially if their seat is in the front row. And when they return to their seat, they're taking their seat literally within 5 feet of Nina Arianda. Mm. And he says, I can't stop them from doing that. And I said, well, you know, sir, it's done in other places. You may not be aware of that. Am I the only person who sees this happening more and more? Everyone I talk to is like, oh, I never seen that, or, oh, it's always been happening. They say one of those two things.
What's fascinating to me here is that I know for a fact the Manhattan Theater Club has on its balcony level a monitor where they're showing the show.
I didn't even know that.
So as a result, they really could send people up there and say, watch it up there. So that... that is an option. So so that's even more surprising to me.
Well, in my experience, this is becoming epidemic, and I think it's got to be nipped in the bud, or it's only going to get worse and worse, and people are going to feel like they can come and go as if they're in their living rooms. I mean, it's bad enough when they're seated on the aisles, which they almost never are. Mm-hmm. You know, every time they get up, they disturb four or five people to the left or right of them. They go out. They do whatever it is they have to do or think they have to do. And then they come back and they do it all over again. You know, I'm sorry. But anyway, aside from that.
And the show, right?
Yeah. Yes. And other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, yeah. I was thrilled by Nina Arianda. I did not see the play downtown. The first time I saw her was in Born Yesterday, in which I thought she was terrific, but that's a different kind of a situation. The role is so much associated with someone else. And also, in this case, I think it was one can see why it was a star-making performance if you have a person with the talent, because the character's identity is her true identity is somewhat in question, which gives it all kinds of levels. And also, she gets to use at least three distinctly different voices and accents during the course of the play. And she did them all beautifully. And I might add also, Hugh Dancy, I had never heard him do an American accent before. Apparently he has in other things, but this was the first time I heard it. I thought his American accent was absolutely spot on. And then it made it all the more effective when he reverted to his actual British accent for the scenes of the play within the play, as it were. So I thought they were both terrific. This is another one of those plays that seem to be coming, you know, very quickly lately, where there are things you are not supposed to discuss because they would be termed spoilers, but it's hard not to discuss them if you're having a critical discussion of the play, because the question is whether they are successful or not. So you're kind of hamstrung by the author in not being able to talk about what you might perceive as flaws in the writing, because they would be considered spoilers. I don't know how much more I should say, but there is a – it becomes – well, it becomes a matter of discussion as the play proceeds, how much of what this actress is saying about herself is true and how much is not. So, and I don't know. Also, there seems to be more of a trend lately where you writers write things like leaving certain questions open. And as I've said recently, I certainly don't feel like every question has to be answered in a play. But if you're really confused about ultimately what the meaning is and who someone is supposed to be, I don't know if that's a good thing either. I guess there are degrees of it, obviously. I don't know, Peter, if you'd like to say anything on that without giving it too much away.
No, I follow you there. I understand exactly what you mean, and I'm inclined to agree with you. There are a lot of people who say, oh, you want things wrapped up nicely with a nice little bow. You know, well, I don't mind getting packages that are wrapped up nicely with bows. I think they look better when I get them than packages that aren't that way. So, yes, I understand that some playwrights don't want to do that, and sometimes I wonder if they don't do it because they don't know themselves exactly how this should play out. And it's much easier to just say, "Well, you know, it's up for you to interpret." You know, so I'm not saying that that's the case here with David Ives. What I am saying is that I've seen that plenty of times happen. So I understand your frustration on that, Michael.
Yeah, and as far just one more thing on the discomfort of the audience. It's interesting that you perceive that. I mean, I didn't necessarily perceive that, mm-hmm. but maybe it would explain all these comings and goings that I saw during the performance. But the thing about that is, you know, what's in Venus in Fur is unbelievably mild compared to
things
I've seen recently. We can't talk about it in detail now because it hasn't opened yet, but there is a play called Burning at Theater Row that the new group is doing, and it has, I can say this because it's factual, it has the most explicit sex and nudity and the more of it than I have ever seen in any other play in my life, and everyone I've spoken to agrees. And I'm with you, Peter. I've always felt I personally have always felt that it's hard to respond erotically to mm-hmm. something that happens on stage because of the venue, you know, and because mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. I've always wondered if other people feel that way, because I mean I guess I've asked individual people, but I can't poll an entire audience. But I tend to agree with you that it's hard to, and especially the more explicit it becomes, I think the more the reaction of the audience tends to be discomfort rather than being titillated. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it's interesting that you say that, because there's really no, I mean, she at one point wears fairly scanty clothing, but it's not even semi nudity. I wouldn't even describe it that way.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
This has more to do with the Manhattan Theater Club audience than it has to do with the level of what's going on.
Right. But what I mean is it wasn't even it's like,
sure.
You know, it's 10% of what I've seen.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
All righty. So that kind of wraps up Venus in Fur. But let's take a look at our last discussion of the day, which is Other Desert Cities, which playing down at the booth, which came from Lincoln Center Theater. Peter, why don't you start us off with Other Desert Cities?
Well, it's Christmas Eve, and the family is getting together. It's mother, dad, brother, and sister. There's also an aunt on the scene, too, the mother's sister. They wrote together for a while and had a nice collaboration, with a populous series. And the father was an actor and a rather successful one, even though you get the impression he never remotely got anything like an Oscar nomination, but because he was in Shoot 'Em Ups and properties like that. But they're living well. There's a lot of money. Money doesn't seem to be a factor. And there has been a family tragedy, however, because there was a third child. And I won't say too much about what happened to that third child, but let's just say, and this is an understatement, the child was a disappointment. Now the daughter has decided to write about that situation, and the parents are livid that she's going to spill the family secrets and air a tremendous amount of dirty laundry. My problem with other desert cities is the fact that the daughter is astonished that her parents wouldn't be more supportive of her writing this new book. I do not begin to understand why she is so aghast at the fact that they want this kept quiet. So the play doesn't work for me on that level. Getting past that, and this was the second time I had seen the show, getting past that, it's terrific. But there's that fundamental flaw for me that she just doesn't get it. And I can't imagine that anybody wouldn't. She fully expects that when the parents read the book, and they do, they're reading it during intermission, in fact, that they're going to be thoroughly convinced. They're going to say, oh, honey, it's a work of art, and you know, you have our blessing and all that. And it doesn't play out that way at all. So, but in terms of crisp dialogue and interaction with people and funny, witty lines that are right for the characters, it's a tremendously entertaining evening. And I did miss Linda Lavin, who has gone on to other properties. I did miss her quite a bit. But aside from that, I thought the production was quite strong and enjoyed it immeasurably. But, oh, I don't understand why this kid hasn't more understanding.
Peter, I think you have identified a major flaw in the play, and that's exactly what I said.
Huh.
It's funny. I also saw it off-Broadway when it was at Lincoln Center, and when I saw it there is a it's fair to say there's a major twist towards
yes.
the end.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure about that twist when I first saw it, but now that I've thought about it and now seeing the play again, to me it seems completely credible. So that is the good news that I thought that might have been a big flaw, but it wasn't. But in this case, it's not only the fact that she, you know, I mean, they do pay lip service. There is a point where one of the parents or both say something to the effect of, how could you possibly have thought we would be okay with this? So mm-hmm. at least they address it. But it's not so much that she thinks they won't have a problem with it, but when the play opens, the first 20 minutes or so are a completely delightful, very light comedy in which the daughter participates. There's, you know, a light conversation about the weather and, you know, various foibles of family members and, you know, living in Palm Desert or Palm Springs or wherever they're Palm Springs. And it's almost like it's a light comedy. And then, but you think, well, she knows she has this book. She's brought this book with her. She's going to drop this bombshell. How could she be so carefree and light? I mean, I think that, forgive me, but I think if he had rewritten it so that she came in later and didn't participate in all that delightful light comic badinage, I think that it would have been a much more believable situation. Because did that strike you as, you know, aside from what you already said, Peter, that she could just be seem so carefree and, you know, while knowing that she had this thing that she was about to drop on them?
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. On a personal level, I used to write books for young adults. I did about 10 of them. And one of them was called The Most Embarrassing Mother in the World. And do you know, I never let my mother know that I wrote such a book. It had nothing to do with her. Nothing at all. I wouldn't even let her know that I had written a book by that title. She went to her grave never knowing that that was one of my books. She knew all the other ones, but she right. never knew that I wrote that one, because I didn't even want to hurt her feelings for a tenth of a second, making her think, oh my God, is he writing about me? You know. Yeah. So as a result, I'm amazed that this young woman, who is indeed writing, she makes it very clear. She says, this is not a novel. This is a memoir. And you also think, well, why couldn't it be a novel?
Right.
At least that would help a little.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, so it really seems like she has a real agenda here. And that's fine if there are kids who want to get back at their parents and do it like this, and all right. You know, I mean, there are two sides to every story, and maybe the kid really has a gripe and has a real agenda. And I saw a play last night where a kid was referring to her parents as monsters. And, you know, all right, if you have monster parents, maybe it is valid that you blow the whistle on them. But you cannot expect them to embrace what you've written under those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that did not ring true at all, and it really took me out of the play, and I think it is a major flaw, and I'm surprised at John Robin Bates that he didn't realize that. I mean, I'm trying to justify that in my mind, how someone could have, something like that they're about to spring on these people, and yet there's absolutely no indication of it for the first half hour or so, which is just, just a domestic comedy and a very enjoyable one. So anyway.
All righty. Michael got a chance to go see a site-specific play called It Is Done, which is running in Midtown on the West Side. But before we talk about that, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right below that logo, there's a subscribe button. If you click on that, it'll bring you to iTunes, and that way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded. You can listen to This Week on Broadway and other Broadway radio shows in other ways. You don't have to listen in iTunes. You can listen to it through Stitcher, Stitcher, which is an application for your most mobile devices. That way you can stream our shows without downloading, which was good to go when you're on the go, especially if you're on the road. I had some folks from National Tours write in and tell us that it's great because they can just listen to us when they want. You can also listen to us in the Google application called Listen, which is for Android devices. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, which is Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. They broadcast us. Thank them for that. And if you would like to get in touch with us, you can go to BroadwayRadio.com, and all our contact information is there. There's phone numbers, email addresses, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts for Peter, Michael, myself. So come reach out and let us know what you think about the show. So, Michael, you got to see the It Is Done site-specific show. It's at the Mean Fiddler Bar and Grill, is that?
Yes, which is basically directly opposite the Friedman Theater.
Okay.
They have a performance, well, what they're using in this case is a performance space in the basement. And I really enjoyed this piece by Alex Goldberg, who I was not previously familiar with, but I'm definitely going to be following him. Isn't it great when you come across something really terrific, in a totally unexpected place like that? I just went to this because, for several reasons, but the site-specific aspect of it was intriguing to me, and also I used to go to that space when it was a cabaret space, and I wanted to see how they used it. But I didn't really have any expectations. It was fantastic. I'll be brief. It's about a guy who shows up at a bar in a remote location on a dark and stormy night. And the bartender at first is the only other person there. There are no other customers. It's made clear that the bar is basically the only place of its kind within 90 miles. They're really in the middle of nowhere. The guy comes in because I forget if his car is broken down or if it's just that the weather is so bad that he pulled over. And so it's just the two of them for a while. And the bartender's a little weird. So you think that he might be the engine of some kind of bad thing that's going to happen. But then this woman shows up, and she at first purports to be just another stranger who just happened to get caught in the storm and just happened to come into this place that's 90 miles from any other kind of civilization. And then she starts talking with the bartender and this other guy, and there's, you know, flirtation and more than flirtation, and then it takes a really, really interesting turn in terms of her relationship with the other customer. And I won't say any more, but I found it much better written than many other things I've seen lately. I think, Peter, I think you'd really enjoy it because it it does you know, it's more like a well-made play, and I mean that in the best sense. Even though there is a, it turns out there's a, well, let me say there's a supernatural element, but to me it was done in a way that there were not, there was not the confusion that there might be in something like Venus and Fur, as to exactly what is happening ultimately. So you get the thrills, you know, of the wondering what's going to happen and the supernatural elements, but then you do also it's very clear at the end what the point of the play was and what and who everyone's supposed to be. So I would recommend it. It runs through December 5th, but not every evening. Let's see, www.itisdonetheplay.com is the easiest way for you to find out more about it.
I want you to know that if you go to that website, it plays a very loud sound that blew my ears out when I looked
it
up.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that.
I hate that in websites, but just to warn everybody, if they're listening right now and they go right to it, to take your headphones off or whatever. It's terrible.
Sorry about that.
I'd like to say, just as Michael said, isn't it terrific when you come across something like this that you don't anticipate? I'll very quickly say that... on Sunday night, I went to a glorified tech rehearsal of A Christmas Story in Hershey, Pennsylvania. This is a new musical, and I thought it was very, very good. But more to the point, as I wrote in my Critzoland column about it this week, there was one song that just intoxicated me, and for this entire week, it has been playing in my head, and even last night, I couldn't get to sleep, seriously, because it was still going through my head, because I just love this song so much, called Ralphie to the Rescue. If you know A Christmas Story, you know that he wants a BB gun for Christmas, and one of the smart things about the show and the original story is that he wants the gun because he wants to protect people from being victimized as opposed to going up to a Texas tower and killing people. So as a result, he has this very country song parody, Ralphie to the Rescue, that is so wonderful. And as I ended my Critzoland review, isn't it wonderful when you end the day knowing and loving a song that you didn't even know a few hours earlier existed? I mean, it's just such a lovely, lovely thing. So as a result, I share Michael's enthusiasm for coming across something unexpected and appreciating it wildly. So if you live in Detroit, Raleigh, Tampa, or Chicago, keep an eye out for A Christmas Story. I think it'll bring you a lot of pleasure.
Well, I want to point out that if you go to A Christmas Story, themusical.com, it plays a very loud song when you first load it up. So don't listen to it with headphones on. It just blew my ears out.
Is that true?
Michael, what were you saying?
Were you joking about the second one, Jen?
No, I just did it. A Christmas Story, the musical, which is a beautiful website. It's great, but my goodness, it's so loud. Very nice. Benji Pasek and Justin Paul wrote it. Is that we talk about the same show?
Yeah.
It's a very nice website. It's a very nice show. Chicago this Christmas, doing a national tour. They're in Hershey right now. Yeah, it's a very nice.
I just wanted to say, now it's played previously, right,
Peter? Yes, I know it was in Seattle, and I think it was somewhere. I think Kansas City, maybe.
And a friend of mine. I just have to say, a friend of mine who never likes anything. flew to see it, one of those two places, I think Seattle, because he loves the movie so much. And he loved it. He never likes anything. He loved,
Mikey.
This show. Hey, Mikey. Yeah, hey, Ralphie.
Yeah, hey, Ralphie, that's right. Well, that's great. It looks like a very fun show. At least the website makes it good, and the website place has that music on it, so you can take a listen to some of these songs.
Well, people forget because there have been so many musical stage adaptations of films that have not been successful. People forget that some of them have been tremendously successful and you know, mm-hmm. will be with us forever because they're so great. Mm-hmm. Like Hairspray, just to pick one out of, you know. So there's nothing wrong with the idea, you know, there's nothing wrong with that process in itself. It just needs to be done mm-hmm. properly.
Absolutely.
As apparently it has been in this case. And I'm so happy.
I do not care where musicals come from, what they're adapted from, as long as they're good. You know, I have no problem with movies. People think that this is some sort of epidemic thing. As long as the shows are good, what difference does it make?
Right.
All righty. So I guess we can wrap up here. Do you guys have anything else you want to throw in?
I'm done.
No. I did want to say that I saw Standing on Ceremony, which opens tonight, which is wonderful. And maybe we can speak about that next week.
Yeah, we're gonna
I'm
talk
going
about,
this afternoon.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Standing on Ceremony next week. What else did we want to talk about next week? I closed my notes. It was something else. Oh, well.
All righty.
So come back next week. We'll talk about Standing on Ceremony as well as probably some other things. Probably.
Not yet.
You know, see if Julie Taymor sues anybody this week.
Uh-huh.
All righty. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thank you so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I'll sing opera one day. It's like Opry with an A. I told my agent in his fancy car, and it pained him, I could tell, when he said, no chance in hell. They don't let you in the opera if you're a country star. Is it the way I say obligato? So I took that country singing job and shoved it, and I headed to the Met in NYC. I know that stage is hard to reach, but Domingo likes a peach. You should hear that tenor voice sing rockabilly. Now I'm trying out for the barber of Seville. When a voice booms from the house, from those tassels on your blouse, I can tell you've got a twang and play guitar. I bet they loved you in the South, but please don't open your mouth. We can't let you in the opera if you're a country star, 'cause no patron trusts an opera in the hands of a country star. Do you think I can't? Well, 'cause I got long pink fingernails. I had to play more country songs just to stay afloat. Though I eat as my role, I'm in a southern pigeonhole. I sing like Mary Callis, but no one's heard a note, till I charmed an old blowhard who owns half a Juilliard. Said my singing was so beautiful he cried, and I felt my heartbeat hop. Then I heard his heartbeat stop. He said, welcome to the opera. And then the bastard died. Well, time went by, I gave up on the opera. Grabbed a man, got ready for a kid. Though La Scala never called, my ears still get enthralled when I hear a great soprano blow her lid. So head up to the opera house I did. But as vibrato start to shake, I feel my water break. I'd never even make it down the aisle. If you'd have been there, you'd have seen in that second mezzanine, first a head, then 2 feet from my $90 seat. As I lifted up my gown to the doctor to contraction, contraction, oh! head of the trustees board said, before you cut the cord, here's an 8-year contract and some caviar. You'll start right away, my dear. We have daycare. Please sign here. Been my dream since our same country. Now I'm an Oberstorch. But you were the best part of the opera by far. Now a crib ain't where you're needing pearls of wisdom. But listen up before you've cried a word. When you hear no, don't get upset. It means yes, but just not yet. Fight the most when folks say you're absurd. In the end, I believe we all get heard. But if I may suggest one rule, before I'm no longer cool, what you do ain't always who you are.